Okay, so good morning, everybody. I'm very happy to be here, but not very happy to be giving this talk. And that's Arnon's fault, who volunteered me. At any rate, I'm gonna tell you about something that I'm really quite excited about, and hopefully it will be a bit provocative. So this being, hard as it is to imagine, election season, I'm reminded of what I thought was actually a very interesting debate, which I'm guessing that very few people in this room know about or even remember, and that is when Ross Perot ran for president. And his vice presidential candidate was a guy named Admiral Stockdale, and I frankly encourage you to go look him up online, because he was really quite a guy, even though he looked like an idiot in the debate. And when he started out, the first thing he said was, "Who am I? Why am I here?" That's that he became famous for that. And so I feel that way. I'm not going to talk about evolution or cell biology. So in some sense, that's disturbing in the context of what we're doing at this meeting. Sorry? Potato. I remember it. Yeah, so all I can say is that if each of us had a microphone in our faces all the time, 24/7, I think most of us would look like idiots, but he was especially bad. So what this talk is about is something that I think evolutionary cell biology must speak to, and that is the sort of overarching importance and diversity of allostery. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to introduce to you, in some sense, a class of models. And in a certain way, I think of there as being one equation that rules them all. So to some extent, what I'm doing is giving a groupie talk. So I'm a Ned Wingreen and Leonid Mirny groupie. And I got so excited by what those guys taught me that I'm actually in the middle of writing a book about this. And cheers to you, Ned. I wish Leonid was here as well. So, you know, I really like Escher, and I like this particular thing because I think it's very interesting to look at the world either through the fly's eyes or in a spherical mirror, because the distortion sometimes is very interesting. Okay, so enough of that. So Jacques Monod, in the early 1960s, we just passed the 50th anniversary of the introduction of the allostery concept. It first appeared in this paper by Monod, Changeux, and Jacob. And this paper appeared in 1963, and then in 1965 they had a statistical mechanical model which was a follow-up to this paper, and between the two of them there's about 10,000 citations of these two papers. And the thing that I think is really fun is that when Monod discovered this phenomenon, the allosteric phenomenon, he actually referred to it as the second secret of life. And what he had in mind was that we're 10 years past the discovery of the structure of DNA, and so that's what he had in mind when he said the first secret of life, although I would call that hyperbole, given that they hadn't mentioned evolution. But at any rate, for the modern molecular era, I think it's quite bang on, actually, to call this the second secret of life. And so at this 50th anniversary last year in Paris, there was a very interesting meeting, and it was a meeting basically to celebrate the discovery of allostery. And it was a little weird because it was one of these meetings that had on the order of 10 Nobel Prize winners. And maybe some of you know what I'm talking about, where you get a bunch of people together with all the fancy older people kind of reflecting on their careers. But it was also fascinating. And one of the reasons that I found it fascinating was that we had talks on all of these different classes of problems, and my claim is that if you look at this, then basically what we're doing is covering entirely broad swaths of all of biology. So let's just go through them. So that's hemoglobin. So, you know, I just saturated my hemoglobin, and this guy is basically an oxygen carrier, and it is one of the first molecules that was thought about in the context of allostery. This one is one example of a transcription factor. It happens to be the lac repressor molecule, but there are many different transcription factors that are allosteric. What do I mean by that? I mean that a ligand can bind to the molecule and either activate it or inactivate it. Both scenarios actually happen. This is a G-protein coupled receptor, another one that if it gets tickled by a ligand, it will change conformation and will do something. the ATP synthase was talked about by John Walker, and then the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor is basically present at neuromuscular junctions and the ribosome and so on. So my claim is basically that we've got all sorts of different realms covered. This is neuroscience, this is the study of motility and myosin motors, this is cell signaling, this is gene regulation, this is physiology, this has to do with the energy budget of cells, that's the central dogma. So my main point is that the claim is that this allosteric concept has very broad reach. So what I'm very interested in about this class of models is that I think of it as being a meta-concept. And I would just want to say a few words about what I mean by that. So the first time I learned about mass spring systems, I was kind of disturbed, as I am in general, with how boring freshman physics is. So the point is that, you know, you learn about some mass and spring on a frictionless table, and it just seems somehow not very interesting. What can I say? And yet, a little while later, I was reading this book by Holliday and Resnick, and I was really kind of blown away with this table, which, you know, maybe is a straightforward triviality to all of us, but I don't think it should be. In other words, this reminds me very much of what it's like to fly across the Atlantic from Europe and to pass Greenland and to see all of the shades down. What's up with that? What's wrong with people? Why don't they look out the window at Greenland? So here, what I have to say is it's pretty mind-blowing that a mass spring system and an electrical oscillator are exactly the same thing. That's a meta-concept. So resonance is an example of a meta-concept. I used to do experiments on my kids. We'd go to the swing set, and then I would close my eyes, and I would push at a frequency of my own choosing. And so, you know, what's funny about that is that you get to actually see how resonance works. And you can imagine some of the things that happen. So, you know, they're on an upswing and you're on a down push. It leads to a little collision. Anyway, that's fun. So this is one example of a meta concept. And then a second example, and I think I might have learned about this partly from Shira Grossberg, has to do with the fact that I can describe the diffusion of some molecule in solution, and I'll write down the diffusion equation. And yet, I can also write down an equation for the conformations of a polymer, where the question I ask is, what's the probability that I'll find the end of a chain at position X, given that the chain has N links? So think of a paperclip chain, and you drop it on the ground, it'll make a blob. The size of that blob will scale like the square root of the number of paperclips, and I'm just saying that the way that Joe Blitzstein likes to say this is that the nouns change, but the verbs stay the same. And that's what I mean by a meta-concept. So, I claim that allostery is such a meta-concept. And in particular, you know, with a nod to Lord of the Rings, there's one equation that rules them all, and it's not the Hill function. It's actually this rational function, which I'm going to try to explain to you today with a couple of examples. And what I have in mind here is the kind of different kind of phylogeny. So we've already heard last week quite a few phylogenies, but what I'm thinking of here is a conceptual phylogeny. And in particular, I'm thinking about the way that one might teach biology or write a book about biology. So if you're to look at, you know, a big cell biology book, you might find the treatment of hemoglobin to be 500 pages away from the treatment of ion channels, which might be 100 pages away from the treatment of cell receptors and so on. And yet I'm claiming that in principle, you could talk about every last one of these things in 3 pages and say, you know, they're kind of the same thing. Yes.
So you're saying that allosteries have
ligand-induced
conformational change. Can we roll in,
like, post-translational
modification-induced conformational change?
I would. Okay. Yeah. The only thing about it is that it's a little, I definitely do, and so this little book I'm writing, it includes that, but the thing about the phosphorylation or post-translational modifications, it's not so easily reversible. It's usually enzyme-mediated, but that's not the end of the world, but I'm just saying that the ligand binding and unbinding case is really simple, and the post-translational modification needs the intervention of some enzymes usually. But that, yeah, definitely I would include that. Anything anyone else wants to say? So this refers to Monod, Wyman, and Changer. Yeah. And by the way, I'm going to ignore, there's a whole historical sort of polemic between Monod, Wyman, and Changé, and then Koch, Lund, and Company had an alternative model. As far as I'm concerned, they're the same thing. I know that would probably not make the key players very happy, but I'm just saying that they both correspond to conformational change induced by ligands. Okay, so I'm going to tell you two vignettes. I only have 23 slides, and at this rate, I'll be done at 9:30, I'd be fine with that. So the first vignette that I want to tell you about has to do with ion channels. And in particular, what I want to think about is what happens at a neuromuscular junction. So I happen to love both of these figures. So this is basically a microscopy image of a neuromuscular junction. The basic idea is that these are muscle fibers, and these are synapses, and this is basically a higher resolution view. This is called the motor end plate. And if I were to make a cartoon of what goes on there, the idea is shown here. So basically what happens is that an action potential arrives down here. That leads to the flow of calcium ions across the membrane, which leads to vesicle fusion and release of neurotransmitters, which then bind on the other side to the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor, which is gated and then permits the flow of both sodium and potassium. Okay, and the details don't matter much to what I'm going to try to say, because I'm really focused on the allostery itself. So what is this allostery thing anyway? What do I mean by that? So the thing that I would say is that in a nutshell, the simplest version of allostery is it's the idea that molecules can exist in two conformational states which have different activity, and that the preference for those two states is guided by or changed by the presence of some ligand. So there's a number of different kinds of ion channels. There are voltage-gated ion channels. There are ligand-gated ion channels, and that's what I'm going to focus on. And there's also mechanical tension-gated channels. Probably in the early days, but once again, for me, I don't think it should be. In principle, you could have four states, it wouldn't really change anything except a proliferation of, you know, number of microstates to consider in the statistical mechanical sense, and probably a proliferation of parameters, that kind of thing. But in principle, there's nothing stopping us from going to higher numbers of states, and indeed, in the ion channel literature, there's lots of, like in the case of mechanosensitive channels, there's sometimes five different states, for example. Okay, so here's a view I showed you earlier, which is a side view and a top view of nicotinic acetylcholine receptor. It's a heteropentamer. This gray stuff is the lipid bilayer. And these two sites correspond to where the ligand, which I told you is released and showed you here, the ligand that's released binds. And that basically tilts the free energy in favor of the open state. So that's what the idea is. And so what I want to do is now kind of walk you through how one might go about thinking about this. So this is a nice paper from Henry Lester's group, in which what they did is they basically mutagenized this heteropentamer, and they measured the current going through the channel as a function of the ligand that gates the channel. And you can see that there's large changes, you know, tenfold changes in the gating concentration for these different mutants. But I also want to point out, in my opinion, this plot is very sneaky in a bad way. And the thing that I'm bugged about is that it's plotting normalized current. Normalized current means they think that it's zero when there's no ligand present, and they think that it's one when there's saturating concentrations. And I would just like to point out, and I'm going to show you in a few minutes, that actually this guy is open most of the time, even in the absence of ligand. And the reason that that's interesting and important is, maybe I'll just quickly say that it's like one of my private little rants, but you know, people like to do things like write equations of this form, where they'll say, for example, that the open probability is given by this. So this is a classic Hill function. But let's stare at that for a second. What does it say will happen when C is 0? It says the probability of being open is 0. And what does it say will happen at large concentration? It says the probability of being open is 1. This model has no provision for a different dynamical range. It has no provision for leakiness. It basically is just a phenomenology with no mechanistic underpinning whatsoever. So I find that very annoying. So at any rate, this issue of plotting the data in this way is sneaky, and I'm going to come back to that. So how would we think about this problem? So if I were to use statistical mechanics, what I would do is I would appeal to what Boltzmann says, and let me, just because there are students in the course that haven't thought about this probably in a long time, so let me give you my spin on what Boltzmann tries to tell us. So Boltzmann wants to tell us how to think about the probability of the different microstates that this system can adopt. So let me talk about the microstates. My claim is that this channel can exist in one of 8 distinct states, okay? And I'm going to act them out. So there's the closed state, and the closed state has 4 different states of occupancy: empty, bound here, bound there, doubly bound. That's 4 of the 8. Okay, open, same deal. Empty, bound here, bound there, doubly bound. So that's 8 states. I just showed them to you. And the question is, how do I figure out the probability that one of these, I don't care which one, that one of these is present? Well, I need to appeal to some sort of probabilistic scheme. And what Boltzmann tells us is, he says, well, what you should do is figure out the energy of each of those states and then put a minus sign in front of it, divide it by KBT, and then exponentiate it. And that tells you the probability of that particular state. I think I will try to illustrate this. It's one of my favorite experiments. I hope I don't break this thing. So my plan is to levitate. Okay, so just hold on. Okay, so that didn't work. Now why is that? It didn't work because my e to the minus mgh, if I wanted to levitate, according to Boltzmann, what I have to do is I have to examine mgh relative to KBT. So what's M for Rob? Unfortunately, it's 100 kilograms. I apologize, hard to do anything about. G is 10 meters per second squared, and even if I was modest in my desire for levitation and only even tried to go for a micron, 10 to the minus 6 meters, even then the energy scale here, mgh, is really quite large. KBT, on the other hand, is roughly 4 times 10 to the minus 21 joules. So that tells me about the currency, the energy currency for microscopic processes. And so with my body, I can't access it. George Gamow had these wonderful ideas about what the world would look like if you had a different speed of light, or if you had a different Planck's constant. And you could also do a different KB. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And so that's why I put the word proportional to. And you're going to see, let's go ahead and look at it, but I'm going to come back to it. You can see here that when I look at this denominator, what I did is I added up all of these. So this is 1 plus x plus x plus x squared. So if I sum them, I get 1 plus 2x plus x squared, which I can factor into 1 plus x squared. So this thing right here is exactly what you said. It's just adding up all 8 of these. Yeah, so that's right. So at any rate, what does Boltzmann say? Well, so what Boltzmann says in money terms is, let's imagine that I had $1 million in $20 bills. And the question we're going to ask is, how many ways can I distribute the $20 bills out to all of you? So let's do the first case. There's n people in the room besides me, and let's say I keep all of the money except one $20 bill. How many ways can I distribute that $20 bill? N ways, because there's N of you. I could give it to Aaron, I could give it to Nicole, I could give it to Mike, I could give it to Shelley. So there's N ways of doing that. If I keep all but two $20 bills, then there's more ways to do it. I could give two of them to Aaron, I could give one to him and one to Niranjan, I can keep on doing that. So what Boltzmann tells us is, he says, the number of ways of distributing $20 bills is basically, as I increase the amount that I keep, then there's fewer and fewer ways to hand them out amongst all of you. Now, what does that have to do with the physics of me levitating? The idea here is that instead of money, it's basically energy units that are being partitioned, and the $20 bill is KBT. So that's kind of the currency. And so what we see is that in order to borrow energy from the reservoir, the more and more I borrow, the less likely it gets. Okay, so back to this thing. So what I've plotted here is the 8 states that I already referred to. What I'm interested in is finding the probability of these 4. And if you want to, let's just examine what I've done here. So first of all, I've taken this guy to have energy 0. That's why e to the minus 0 gives 1. I've taken the energy of this guy to be epsilon. So that's why this shows up as e to the minus beta epsilon. And then all this extra stuff here has to do with the free energy that you gain when you bind a ligand. So the interesting idea, the very subtle, wickedly subtle idea that Monod, Wyman, and Changeux had, and I still don't really understand why they thought of it, and I need to ask Changeux about it, is why did they realize that these binding energies should be different? Okay, so notice that binding a ligand in the closed state is different than binding in the open state. That's absolutely critical. Proof. What happens if the KD in the two states is the same? In other words, I've gotten rid of epsilon closed and open and replaced it by KD and kappa D. Look what happens in this expression if KD and kappa D are equal. The parentheses cancel out, and I'm left with a constant that does not depend on C. So no matter what concentration I have, I will never gate this thing. Okay? So the clever, nuanced thing that they did is they said that the binding energy is different in the two states, closed versus open. So what I've got here is this one equation that rules them all. It says the probability of being open is this thing, which is the sum of all those states, divided by all the states. Okay. So now this is where Ned comes in. Yeah, Michael. No, I'm complaining about it in every possible sense. I just think it's got no merit. And because it's got no mechanistic underpinning of any kind. It's got no leakiness, it's got the wrong saturation. To my mind, it's got nothing except that it's sigmoidal. That's the only thing that I would say it's got going for it.
Well, I guess, but the lack of the zero, the problem with the zero end, at least, is because of that. That's the state that you need to allow for the leakiness.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and the way to see that is to set C equal to 0, because then what you'll see is that P open is equal to e to the minus beta epsilon over 1 plus e to the minus beta epsilon. That's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah. So mu is the chemical potential, and what it is a simple way to account for the fact that I have a reservoir, and I stole a particle out of the reservoir to bind, and I changed the entropy of the reservoir. That's what it really is. In other words, it's basically a way of accounting for the fact that I took this ligand. So, you know, you should think of the box where the channel is sitting. So here's the picture. I've got this channel. It's sitting in a membrane. And then there's all these ligands all around in this box. And they have an entropy. And when I take one of them and I bind it here, I change the entropy. And I better account for that. And so that's what the mu accounts for. So it's a shorthand way of representing the reservoir. And it's super clever. Not me, Gibbs.
So that's basically
yeah, that's exactly right. Yep, that's right. So this, if you like, you can think of it as a competition. And in fact, that's why when F is 0, I get probability 1/2. That's exactly the point where the Velcro of sitting my butt down on the chair is exactly compensated by the entropy that I lost. In other words, I exactly balance with advantageous binding energy the entropy loss when I took the guy out of solution. So you're right. Epsilon, this is enthalpic, and it's binding, and that's the entropic term. Anything else anyone's wondering about? Okay, so this was basically a homework, the next thing I did, in response to one of Ned's papers. So, and I might have time to tell you about that. So this is the data that, and actually this is mislabeled. This should actually say normalized current right here. So this is the data that I showed you earlier, and basically what I did is I worked out a one-parameter family. What I mean by that is that, again, this goes back to, you know, my complaint about that equation. What would somebody, I know what somebody would do because that's what they did in this paper. They fit it to a hill function. That means every curve corresponds to a different KD. But actually, I would claim that the binding has nothing to do with the mutants. That's not where, they didn't mutate near a binding site. So I claim you should keep these kappas and k's the same, and the only parameter that should have changed is this epsilon. And that's demonstrated over here, where instead of plotting with respect to concentration, I plot with respect to what I would like to call the Bohr parameter. Now, why would I call it the Bohr parameter? It's a little bit of a long story, but this is basically, I don't know how many of you have heard of it, but let's exploit our hemoglobin again. So that helps always. So the binding curves of oxygen for hemoglobin depend on the pH. This was actually discovered by Christian Bohr, father of Niels Bohr, and it's another like little wicked thing, clever thing about the hemoglobin molecule that has to do with the ability to carry molecules to and from tissues. And so the idea here is that I can, this may sound like a tautology, but I can rewrite this thing in this form. Okay, it's straightforward to do so. And then if you do, then this kind of suggests that all of these curves will fall on one universal curve. And interestingly, all I have to do on this axis instead of plotting with respect to concentration is plot with respect to the Bohr parameter. Another way of saying this, and you know, again, maybe Ned would like to contribute, but to me, this is like finding the Reynolds number of the problem. This is the natural variable. That's not. Plotting with respect to concentration, concentration is not the natural variable. That's the natural variable of this problem. And then all of these guys fall on one curve. And here's the thing that's fun. I want you to notice that this curve, it has its last point right there. In other words, it doesn't go, I actually realized, hey, that channel's open half the time. So I went to Henry Lester, and I said, Henry, you plotted the normalized current, and you made it sound as though the thing is closed when there's no ligand, but I think it was even open half the time. And he said, yeah, how did you know? And I said, because it only makes sense conceptually if you use what I think is a more correct model. And if you do, then you find that this thing is half open, even in the absence of ligand. Anyway, so this is all that I have to say about the first vignette. Does anyone want to ask anything? It's a relatively quiet morning.
How do you know some of these parameters, like the little epsilon?
So already here, what I did is, I did a fit to the kappa dk. So this is a three-parameter fit, except I'm going to have for each of these guys a different epsilon. So I'm fixing it by saying I insist that all of them have the same KD and kappa D, but I'm allowing them to be different as a one-parameter family. Okay. And that's really what this is telling you. It's just telling you this is indeed a one-parameter family. Yeah? I don't know the answer to that, but I bet you they're not. I don't think they are. But I don't think that they, yeah, I don't think I know the answer to that, but I really doubt that they are. Andrew.
So the open probability is really the probability of being not open in the small range between no ligand and no ligand.
What I would say is that, first of all, I would say that the open probability is the sum of the probabilities of all four of these, and it depends on C. In other words, let's think about what the current would look like. Is there an eraser? So if I were to plot the current going through one of these guys, Well, okay, so first I guess I just want to say, you know, like if it's, this would be the case where it's open most of the time. That's going to be high ligand concentration. So that's high C. And then this is what it might look like at low concentration. So, you know, I would be something like that. So I'm saying when you change concentration, you get different P opens. And this covers the whole spectrum. It covers all the possible P opens. And my other point is that even in the absence of ligand, it's open some of the time. And for that one mutant, I thought it was very interesting, you know, that this guy is open half the time, even in the absence of ligand. It is. Sorry. Yeah. I said that a minute ago. It's mislabeled. I apologize.
Yeah, yeah.
This is not open probability. That's normalized current.
And it's sort of therefore normalized.
It is. Yeah. That's absolutely right. So in fact, what I did is I took P open of C minus P min divided by P max minus P min. That's what's plotted right there.
So it's even worse than a normalization because there's an offset.
Yeah. Yep. It's worse than a normalization. There was indeed an offset. Yeah. Ned.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Which, as I understood, was whether if you had, say, two of these mutations combined,
yeah,
epsilons would be additive.
Right. And I go ahead.
I guess my intuition would be probably yes.
Really?
Because
yeah.
Each one is contributing something to each of the two states. And, you know, that would be the leading term.
Yeah. 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 I think there's only one way to answer a hostile question like that. I'm kidding. I'm curious. We're going to come back to this in a few minutes, but I really want to just ask you now, and we can talk about it. So this is actually from Ned's work with Bonnie Basslertz, and I listened to his talk over the weekend. So you guys heard about the quorum sensing receptor. And I was sorry that Ned didn't show you this, but this is now the chance I've been waiting for. So you don't need to understand or look at this table other than to know that it exists. Okay, what this is, correct me if I'm wrong, Ned, is it's a series of different mutants in the receptors that he told us about on Friday. And for each of those guys, they then measured the response, and in fact, they did something even cooler because they even included a second molecule, okay, to add to the fun. In other words, not only the AI2, was it AI2? I don't remember anymore, but not only that, but they also had a second molecule present, and the data collapses. So I guess I just wonder, did you guys pursue this point? I'm almost sure that in the case of the ion channel and also the LAC repressor, it's not additive.
Uh-huh. Methylate or demethylate,
yeah,
those residues, which is
just yeah, like a yeah, you've got those four Qs, right? Yeah.
That's pretty close to additive.
Yeah. Well, maybe I spoke too fast, but I don't think it's additive in this case. And I'm not sure they did, like, this is that's why the experiment that you like so much from Surik is so cool, is because it was systematically, you know, adding and subtracting Qs and E's. Do I remember Qs and E's or something? So this thing was a bit more haphazard. Not quite, but there was an elbow and alpha helix. They messed around with a leucine in position 9. But I don't know that they really did a double mutant. And I don't know. It's a great question. Yeah. Yeah. Andrew. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, because this was purely on the part of the when they were looking at the ion channel, it was really intended to figure out did they know where the gating sort of took place and could they mess with the probability of opening the channel. But I don't know that there's any mutants that were tuned in an evolutionary sense. Anyway, maybe we'll have time to come back to this because it's very amusing, I think. Yes. Yeah, okay, so I'm going to go. It would indeed, and so I'm going to go back to Ned's paper again. So, sorry, but I told you, I've told you before, I'm a Ned groupie. So I loved this thing that they said in their paper. So I'm going to read it to you guys. Yes? It's a great question, one of my favorites, and I guess what I would say is that there's not a one-size-fits-all answer, but I would say that it's rash to reject equilibrium too quickly. In fact, it reminds me of a story. Last year I wrote an article with the title, Napoleon is an Equilibrium, and the reason is that somebody, I'm not going to mention any people, but a very well-known person was giving a talk at a very well-known university, and at the end a very well-known biochemist, thinking that he was going to be snarky and really kick some ass, says, Napoleon is an Equilibrium. And I'm not really directing that at you, but I guess I would just say, here's the argument. It's one of time scales. If you look at the gating of an ion channel, right here, the time that you're open is long compared to this transition time. And so the binding and unbinding of ligands, it's cool. In other words, you can think of it as an equilibrium thing. And since your background's in physics, think Born-Oppenheimer approximation. You know, are the nuclei frozen? No. But for the purposes of electrons zipping around, are they frozen? Yep. So in other words, you know, there's a ratio of something you can compute and you can say, I feel good about it. But I agree with you, it's a very, very deep question. And it's funny because it's going to come up in a little while because that's going to be the basis of one of the theory projects that I propose for this next 2 weeks in the rotation. So it's really interesting. And it's quite analogous to something that I experienced in my former life and talked about in this very room when I was at Brown, and that is the use of continuum mechanics at very short length scales. You know, if you look in Landau and Lifshitz, there's a story, and it tells you you better make sure that the wavelengths are long compared to atomic dimensions, blah, blah. And that sounds good, but in fact, you find out you can use the equations of continuum mechanics to much smaller scales. I mean, I wasted 10 years on this, looking for the breakdown of continuum mechanics, only to see that I ended up being a real sort of supporter of the continuum perspective. Okay, so I want to read this comment from the Cell paper by Swam, Wingreen, and Bassler. This is answering Mike's question about the k's changing rather than the epsilons in my language. So they said we had reasoned that the dark phenotypes of our Luxen mutants could stem from, and then they give us a list, a defect in the ability to bind AI1. Okay, that corresponds to the Ks, I think. A bias favoring the kinase state, that's an epsilon mutant. A defect in signaling, or some combination of the above. I don't know what 3 is. Fair enough. Okay. So these 1 and 2 are the parameters. And if you get a data collapse with a one parameter family and it's epsilon, you know, I would call it's an epsilon mutant. And that means it's the one that's a bias favoring the kinase state. That's like the case of changing Qs and Es on the chemoreceptors. Super cool. So Tal, sitting right over there, has been thinking about this in the context of transcription factors, and it may not be true that you can isolate, you know, one mutant. Okay. So I guess, does anyone else want to say anything about the ion channel? Because otherwise I'm done with it. Okay. So a different vignette. So the second vignette that I want to talk about is transcription factors and induction. So I'm guessing there's some fraction of people in this room that have pipetted IPTG in their lives. And if you have done so, then basically what you're doing is you're tuning the ligand that binds to a transcription factor, which will fall off of the DNA when there's a lot of it around. And so just a few words about gene regulation. So the students in the course last week had the pleasure, I guess. At least if you haven't done it before, it's a pleasure. If you've done it before, it's probably not a pleasure. But I think it's really one of the most amazing things that one can think about. It's like flying over Greenland. So you start out with some clear solution, with some carbon and some nitrogen and some phosphate, and you put a single bacterium in here, and you put it at 37 degrees and you shake it, and 24 hours later you have 10 to the 10th cells. What's not to like? That's very impressive. So this guy Monod that I already told you about in the context of the MWC model, he, during his thesis, was measuring basically the optical density, that's how milky the solution is, as a function of time. And what he noticed is that when he used more than one carbon source, glucose, lactose, for example, or glucose, fructose, or whatever, glucose, galactose, then the cells would grow until they exhausted the glucose, and then there would be some sort of an adaptation time. This was called enzymatic adaptation, and then they would continue growing. And so here what you see in his thesis is that he tuned the relative amounts of the two sugars in order to systematically move the position of the shoulder. And this led to another one of his great discoveries, which along with Jacob was the idea that there are genes whose job it is to regulate other genes. So Jacob went home and told his wife, these guys both had these big hyperbole statements, but they were feeling excited about their science. He went home and he told his wife that he had made one of the greatest discoveries in science. And, you know, at the time, there was this notion of, from Beadle and Tatum, of one gene, one enzyme. So the thought was, you know, genes correspond to proteins, and the proteins are for doing enzymatic stuff. And he said, oh, I discovered that there are genes whose job it is to regulate other genes. And his wife said, that's obvious. I just always liked that. So at any rate, what they did is they basically determined a truth table, which is, if you have lactose around and you have glucose around, then the gene for digesting lactose is off. If you have lactose around and no glucose around, then the gene for digesting lactose is on. If you do not have lactose, then the gene for digesting lactose is off. So let's see. There's a simple statistical mechanical model. I already showed you this equation, and I'm not going to go into this at all. But you can basically test out the theory of how this repression works. This is the level of gene expression, this is the number of repressors, and this is mainly just to show you that you can test this out and things make sense. But I need it simply to say, well, what about talking to the environment? In other words, if I were on this curve and I now put in some inducer, here I'm getting a lot of reduction in gene expression, and if I put inducer in, it ought to send me up there because now I should no longer repress. And so what people like Mitch Lewis have done is to systematically make mutants where they take the repressor molecule and they either mutate the DNA binding domain or they mutate the binding domain for the ligand or they mutate the tetramerization ability and so on. And this is the kind of curve that comes out. So this is how much fold change there is in gene expression versus inducer. And I want to harken back to the ion channel because I want you to notice very interesting things. This is leaky. This guy is quite leaky, but it also goes to higher fold change. And those two, this is another reason that I'm such a hater on Hill functions. The leakiness and the dynamic range are not independent. And you can prove that. You can actually compute how they're related to each other. And so I think that that's really quite cool and beautiful. And so, you know, this is a perfect example of the nouns changing but the verbs staying the same. So I'm going to act it out. Yeah?
Can you just describe what fold change means?
Yeah, sure. I'm going to do it with my diet. Okay? So I measured my mass on October 30th, and it was charming. And then I had the holiday season, and then I measured my mass on January 2nd. The fold change is the ratio of the mass on January 2nd to October 30th, which is greater than 1. Then I had 6 good months, so then I had a fold change which was less than 1, and then I went to Woods Hole for the summer, and then my fold change went to greater than 1 again. Not that I'm obsessed with it. But anyway, so the fold change here is level of gene expression when you have the transcription factor around, divided by the gene expression when you don't have the transcription factor around. So that's what it means. And so for the graph I showed you, though, the fold change means amount you have in the presence of, or in the absence of inducer, and then in the presence of inducer, that kind of thing. Yeah.
And do these take account of stability?
Say it again.
Stability, so the levels of the protein are the same.
Yeah, right. That, well, okay, so that's the hope and the supposition, although it's a very good question. So Nicole's question, having just listened to one of these lectures on Saturday, I listened to Ned's lecture, and one thing that's interesting is if you listen online, it's very hard to hear the questions, so I'll just repeat it. Her thought was, hey, another reason that you could have differences is not because of the mutations, but because maybe the number of repressors changed. And I think that that's something to worry about. So, you know, to really do this right, I think you'd have to really keep track of the numbers, to be honest. Okay, so nouns change, verbs are the same. I can act it out again. Here's the repressor. It's got two binding sites, empty, bound here, bound there, doubly bound. And then I get in the deformed configuration, so I can't bind DNA. Four states, I'm like Quasimodo. And it's either empty, bound here, bound there, or doubly bound. And so there's nothing really to add. It's exactly the same stuff, which is why I say one equation to rule them all. Now, let me point out that if I were doing hemoglobin, I would have this equation, but there'd be a 4 there rather than a 2, because there's 4 binding sites for oxygen. So, you know, that's one of the things that I think is amusing. Again, you got me going, got me riled up. Hill functions, what would happen? You'd have some weird non-integral n. And you might even try to spin that and give some story about it. But you wouldn't need to do that here. In other words, you'd prescribe n is equal to 4 because there's 4 binding sites, and that's the end of that. It's not a fitting parameter in and of itself. Okay, so so here, it's just to show you the same story, which is, again, imitating what I learned from Ned and from Leonid, but especially from Ned's group. I basically introduced this Bohr parameter again. And what you get out of this data collapse. And I guess, you know, just to give a little bit of a rant, I feel very frustrated in a way with the big data mentality. There's this article on Wired magazine by Chris Anderson called The End of Theory. And he argues that if we just had enough data, then we wouldn't have to think about anything or understand anything because we just, quote unquote, know the correlations. And the reason I'm bringing it up right here is that my claim is that, you know, if you took all this data, it's not very obvious that the natural variable for this problem is this thing. It's not clear to me that you'd figure that out by some sort of clever, you know, computational witchcraft, you know. And even if you did, I don't know that you'd learn anything. But whereas here, it's a commitment. It's a commitment to a particular vision of how the molecules work. Yes. You know, the truth is that I don't know that I actually looked at these points like on a case-by-case basis and figured out who, you know, which guy over here led to which guy over there. So let me just see if I can figure that out on the fly. Yeah, I don't know. It's a good point. Do you know, Tal? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, that's true. It's the part that levels off. So what is that going to mean over here? I guess I think I need to plug in these points and just see kind of what happens, why it becomes a cloud. But I actually think that Jorge is correct about that. Yeah. Yeah.
It's higher than either KDE.
Yeah.
No one responding. It's just bound all the time.
Yeah. True enough. Yeah, you're right. You're right. That's the explanation. Yeah, that's right. I think that's it. Joel. You look pained.
So something doesn't think in math. And maybe everybody else is having this, but I'll shut up and we'll talk about it later lunch. But I'm having difficulty trying to translate this into a biochemistry protein sort of way. So one question might be about these different mutants.
Yeah.
I would just think those are different amino acids. They have different effect on protein. So could you maybe talk about option is back to your equation, it keeps coming back, one equation rule them all.
Yeah, thank you.
What it might mean, say, in an ion channel, if in that certain case, if you have one particular transcription factor that is happier being in the square state when open, and conversely probably happier being in the rounded state when it's bound.
Yep.
So how do you plug in numbers to reflect that biological difference?
Yeah. That's great. That's a perfect question. So there's a lot of pieces to it. So the first thing that's very fun is to actually, instead of plotting P active, to plot the probability of all 8 of these as a function of concentration. And what you'll find is that this one dominates at low concentration, and that one dominates at high concentration.
In the case that I just described.
For the transcription factor. Well, and for the ion channel, it's the same deal, which is this thing. Let's see. This one dominates at low concentration, that one dominates at high concentration.
Right, but different ion channels are going to have different, behaviors,
right? Yeah, so, I'm eating out of your hands because, you know, I would say facetiously that I'm looking forward to the day when Bonnie Bassler's freezers will have mutants labeled not, but I have a dream, not W394L, but instead, epsilon is minus 2.5 kT. That's how I want the Eppendorf tube labeled. In other words, the mutant at the molecule level was you swapped some amino acid for another, but the outcome in this case, and in the case that I'm showing you, is what you really did is you changed the free energy difference between the open and closed state with no ligand present. That's it. That's really what the mutation did. It's saying that there's two wells, open and closed, and that the closed guy is much deeper, and I make this guy a little closer.
Yeah, I would agree. I think one is what the mutation was, and the other is what the mutation did. And I guess what I'm trying to still piece together is how do those things translate? How does this amino acid change affect the protein?
Yeah, so do you remember last week when Casey said that he and I have had all these debates about, you know, do we care about the atoms? And do I care about which residue kisses which residue? I really take the view, you know, I'm going to sound polarizing and overly aggressive, but just for fun, I'm excited for the day when we won't refer to the PDB. In other words, I don't care. In some sense, I mean, I'm not interested in which atom kisses which atom in order to change the binding on the DNA. I don't care. I'm allowed that. Like, you're allowed to care, and I'm allowed to not care. Yeah. No, I think it's appropriate, and I don't know the answer. So, in the case of the repressor. So before I leave this page, again, Ned, you have to correct me if I'm wrong, but what's really cool here is that these are just mutants in the sense of you found some cells. In other words, it's screen, it's mutants in that sense. The ones on the repressor were designed mutants where Mitch Lewis owns that molecule and knows how to mess with it. So he said, I'm going to change the DNA binding domain, I'm going to change the inducer domain, I'm going to change this, that, and the other thing. And they sometimes work the way expected and sometimes they don't. As far as the shifting to the left, again, I don't think I have a very good molecular interpretation of that. And probably it's partly because the residues don't speak to me. And I kind of regret that. You know, I was envious of Casey the other day when he was now having this epiphany of liking the residues. Part of me still wants to resist, but it would be useful. Yeah, Boris. Yeah.
And then still ask, are there more effects than a big shift to the left? Or, right?
Yep.
Basically get, if you like, density of states.
Yep.
Or distribution of these effects, right? So, and then maybe you don't need to know all of these effects by name.
Yeah.
As long as you know that there is a 0.2 probability of this effect shifting epsilon by
yeah.
T to the left.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds to me like it's almost like class of mutants, right? Like the, you know, trafficking mutants, BPS.
Agreed.
There are energy shifting.
That's right. And that's again, this is why this particular paragraph of their paper so resonated with me, because this is the biology, and then they're saying, well, I know how to think about it in terms of the nature of the parameters that move around in this class of models. So I find that very cool. But it's certainly true that you could dig in. In other words, you could choose a given mutant, you could say, let me try and figure out what's the origin of the epsilon. But in a way, that would be, to my mind, it would be like saying, well, there's different binding site strengths for DNA binding of transcription factors, and I could try and figure out why when I change an A to a T, it leads to a minus 0.4 KT change. That's just not my gig, but I think it could be interesting. I guess there's still some. Nicole?
I have an in-the-weeds question and then maybe two big questions.
Okay.
I think they're
good.
Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that this...
Can you tell me what that word means?
Let me back up and say, it seems that this equation, I am definitely in the non now. My mind is a little bit warm right now. But you have to assume that everything else about the relevant proteins is the same, except that there's been some structural change. And I worry about number three here.
Sure.
So
agreed.
And so I wonder to the extent, you know, how much can that be ruled out?
It can really be ruled out pretty well, because not universally. Like, I'm not saying it's across the board, but again, in this case, you got to correct me, but then I'll speak about mine. But I think in this case, these are one parameter families, mm-hmm. and it's the kinase. It's basically the shift. For sure, that's the case here. This one that I was showing you, this one. So it's a one-parameter family, and that's demonstrated there. I feel pretty good about that. In other words, the original way of going after this, there's a case of, probably the most interesting one is there's some beautiful data on hemoglobin. And there's many mutants and also many second molecules around, and they basically fit all the parameters at once, which is useless, in my opinion, even though the data was beautiful. I was able to say, I'm going to insist that the KDs are the same, and I could actually... do a one-parameter family. That seemed pretty excellent in a certain sense. But that rules out, at least at this level, it rules out pleiotropy. For the thing that Tal has been doing, you know, I don't think we have it nailed yet, but only a subset of Mitch Lewis's mutants are one-parameter families. Others of them look like I have to change several at once, and that's what I believe you're talking about, right? Christian? Wait, but they also were in the Hill function mindset. Like, in other words, really, what I think I think what they tried to do is they tried to fit the data. They never ever said any words about the significance of all that stuff. And again, yeah, and also it had no leakiness. It didn't have a changing dynamic range. I mean, it was missing a lot of stuff. You and then you. Yeah. Yeah. It's not cooperative in the way we're used to, but it is cooperative in the sense of sigmoidal binding curve and a slope, you know, at the halfway point that's greater than one. In other words, this is another thing I love about this model is that it's cooperative, but it's cooperative without putting that in. Of course, you could totally put in an extra plus epsilon int right here. Oh, that's a great question. So I can give you about five. So let's draw them. And I think this would be fun for us to all discuss. But so if I draw a binding curve and it looks like that, that's not cooperative, and this one is. And so here are the things that I would say. Here's 1/2, and the slope right here If it's greater than 1, that's cooperativity. A change in the sign of the second derivative, that's cooperativity. A power here greater than 1, that's cooperativity. What else? The definition you just gave, which is that the KD for putting the second guy on is not 2, it's you have an e to the minus something besides. Yeah, but I'm just saying I don't like that definition because this is cooperative and it doesn't satisfy that definition. I'm not sure. What, maybe we should do sit down and think that one through.
All these, I mean, this works for the old-fashioned cooperative and for the physics cooperative and for the slow.
Okay. Okay. I need to sit down with you and think that last part through. Why are you? Yeah. Okay. I really am done. So, did you want to ask something over there? Yeah. I'm pretty scared of the temperature, I have to say. I like it, of course, but I'm scared of it in this setting because already it's hard to feel like you've got an isolated thing, and there's so many other things that go along for the ride with the temperature. Like I'd be worried about Nicole's point about changing the number of repressors and so on. Okay, so yeah. Ah, the big question.
But
good.
Say if you want to save it to later.
Yeah.
And that is this property of elastary something that has evolved, or it's a fundamental physical property? You know, I'm thinking about origin of life.
Yeah.
The first macromolecule interactions. Is this
cool?
The
yeah. So I really am done. So I mean, if people want, I can talk about some other examples. But so let's just talk about your point right now. So. You know, if you, at least according to me, and I've asked a number of you in this room actually about your views of what a syllabus for teaching evolution for undergrads would look like. And I've gotten very, very different answers from different people in this room, which is fun. But I would say that, at least when I do it, I feel that it's quite amusing to talk about the tension between diversity and universality. So on the diversity front, you know, we have the fossils of the Burgess Shale. We have Stella Fumosa, a bizarre cell shaped like a Star of David. What's up with that? You know, Emiliana Huxleyi, deep sea angler, Venus flytrap, blue whale. You know, that's the world out there. So that's pretty amazing. There's all this diversity. But I also think that there's all sorts of interesting universality. I am answering your questions. So this allosteric thing, that's why in my title, you know, again, my title was hyperbole, partly. This is, to my mind, the most common trick that I've seen proteins make. And it's just across the board, molecular motors, rotary motors, the ribosome, transcription factors, ion channels. You know, the list goes on and on of things that satisfy this basic notion of a conformational state that's switched by binding of ligands. So I don't know. I don't know the answer to your question, but that was why I thought it might be a reasonable subject for us to talk about here. So I guess that was waffling. So, you know, coming back to the harmonic oscillator, I guess I grew to love the harmonic oscillator, and that's because everything's a harmonic oscillator. And it was fun to learn why, you know, it's a meta concept. And what I told you today is that you can use the same sort of thinking on totally different examples. So I told you about this one, which is the ion channel case, and I told you about this one, which is a transcription factor. I claimed that you could use this to think about Ned's two examples. So he mentioned in his talk the other day about bacterial chemotaxis, and, you know, I'm not going to talk about it, but you know, this is another figure that really blew my mind. So this is from Ned's paper in PNAS, where what they're doing is they're basically looking at all these different mutants for chemotaxis, and there's a data collapse there. So So the thought is, you know, you can do this for various kinds of receptor, and this is where Leonid Mirny came in. So he actually argued that you could think about DNA and the accessibility of nucleosomes using the same language. So, you know, the idea there is, I don't have a belt, so I can't do the demo, but, you know, if you think about DNA wrapped around the nucleosome, the more deeply bound a given site is, the harder it is to get to. And you should think of this as the closed and that as the open state. And that, too, can be treated as an allosteric problem. So I don't know. I think that's probably enough for one person for one day. So what are the concluding thoughts? First of all, I very much like this comment from Feynman's Nobel speech, and I'm going to read it to you and tell you why I think it's related to this. So he said, theories of the known which are described by different physical ideas may be equivalent in all their predictions and are hence scientifically indistinguishable. So he, I think, was talking about quantum mechanics, matrix mechanics, you know, Schrodinger equation, path integrals. But that could just as well be said for mechanics. You know, I can use Lagrange's equations, Hamilton-Jacobi, energy methods, for, you know, sum of all the forces equals zero or whatever. Here, you know, I could look in Albert's book and I would learn all sorts of interesting things about each of these. I could think about them as a biochemist. I could think about them as a geneticist. I could think about them as a cell biologist. But I could also think about them as a statistical physicist. And this is where the next part comes in. However, they are not psychologically identical when trying to move from that base into the unknown. And so what I think is really interesting about this whole MWC thing, and the reason Leonid Mirny's paper really caught my eye, was he argued that post-translational modification on nucleosomes is basically the Bohr effect. In other words, the Bohr effect is the shift in binding of oxygen to hemoglobin when you change the pH. And the psychological inequivalence for me is who would have thought that thinking about pH changing oxygen binding on hemoglobin would tell me something about post-translational modification of nucleosomes and DNA accessibility of chromatin. To me, that's what's exciting. That's what I think is worth knowing about. So, you know, maybe it's crap, maybe it's not, but I like it. So I'll finish with just acknowledging, first of all, the person who really got me going on the MWC model was Julie Terrio. So we had these total fights for like 5 years every time we were together about the Monod-Wyman-Schanja model, because I really hate it for hemoglobin. I found it to be square peg fitting in a round hole. But now, like, I've become like this religious zealot, so you should fear me. I look at the world and I see an MWC model everywhere I look. So it's been quite a role rehearsal. Anyway, so the five of us have had a great time working together, and that was a big part of our thinking. I sadly tell you about John Whittam, who I talked to about these things every chance I got. You know, he was a great human being and also an amazing scientist and a deep thinker, and I miss him so much. And also Ron Milo. But really, Ned and Leonid Mirny are the guys who got me going on this. And then Sarah Marzen, when she was an undergrad at Caltech, we worked on a paper together on this with Ernan, and it's probably one of my all-time favorite papers that I've been associated with. And then Tal, who's sitting right there, he's the guy who's taken this up, and he's been doing some really interesting work on exactly the question that Nicole brought up, which is, you know, this notion of pleiotropy, whether or not you can insulate given mutations to only single parameters. So I'm very excited that this didn't last for 2 hours, and I'm ready to stop. Yeah, G2. Yeah. So I guess what I would say is that it's also related to Xingbo's question. I think what it would mean is that, you know, when I start out, instead of writing down things in this sort of equilibrium language, what I'm going to have is a bunch of arrows connecting these guys. In other words, I'm going to write down the kinetic thing, and I hope there's a way to, you know, to coarse grain away the ATP hydrolysis, but I'm not quite sure about that. Like, and it's also related to Kim's question about post-translational modifications. So the energy-consuming processes are very interesting, and how to include them in this framework cleanly, so there's a nice story. I don't have it under control. Maybe others do, but I'm not satisfied. Anyway, I think it's good stuff. Yeah. Oh, yeah, sure.
I want to provoke you.
That's so hard to do. Yeah, let's hear this.
Your talk is really a suggestion that Bingo said, which is known as the statement that if you're in equilibrium, you're dead.
Right.
This is counter Bingo said. You are saying that, well, yes, there are non-equilibrium things, but equilibrium is pervasive. Equilibrium really universality, the verbs that we don't change is constant.
Yeah.
Because you said two states is not necessary, nothing is necessary except constants. So that means you essentially came up with a list of very biological examples which are purely statistical mechanics. But we know that there are things which are not equivalent. So how do we, is there a general principle which says something like it's equilibrium except some special things which are out of equilibrium?
Yeah.
Or try to formulate some general principle along this line.
Yeah. So, I mean, so just to repeat Shura's point, it's that it's true that the way I couched the problem today was really in the language of Boltzmann factors and equilibrium. I agree with that. And at least for the transcription factor case, you know, now I'll provoke you back. For the transcription factor case, very interestingly, we can write down the master equations, so the rate equations that describe the probabilities of all the states, solve for the steady states, compute the fold change, and it has the same functional form as the equilibrium guy.
I know, but in writing so, you assume that they're balanced, and therefore it is the same as Boltzmann.
Well, no, it's not. It's not the Boltzmann distribution, though. The probabilities are different, actually. So, we should sit down and
they are assumed to be balanced.
Yeah, they're in steady state, I guess. And I suppose that means that I have detailed balance. Yeah, so then these are the steady state solutions. But I guess what I would say is that I'm not satisfied with our ability to say when the equilibrium assumptions will stand and when they'll break down. I can tell you some ideas from graph theory that Jeremy Gunawardena has been writing down, and that's what we've been doing lately, so solving for the steady states. But what I can tell you, at least qualitatively, but I know you already know this, is that it's a matter of comparing timescales. So just let's talk about transcription. You know, if it's slow for promoter escape of polymerase, then the binding and unbinding of the transcription factor happens many, many times on the time scale before I get release, you know, then I think it's legal. And I suppose, you know, the other thing I would say is that this is the world in a way of Michaelis-Menten. You know, like I would say that, you know, there's a lot to think about because people use that blindly. So I'm very interested in your point, and maybe we can talk about it further. You know, I don't know if I answered you very well. Somebody else was asking something. Andrew.
So I guess I think that's something that's incredibly important to say for at least the biologists in the room. Once it gets into physicists arguing about, you know, exactly what detailed balance is, there are certain things that have a tendency to grab the window. So the crucial thing that Rob is saying is although biology is not equilibrium, Pauline is in this sense an equilibrium, right?
Yep. Agreed.
All biologists were raised knowing and thinking about energy harvesting. It is nevertheless true at the appropriate time scale, all sorts of things can be treated as being in equilibrium because those reactions are so fast relative to being alive or dying, it doesn't matter, right? But both, you know, biology is writ large, not in equilibrium.
Yep. Yeah, that's, I guess that's the take I would have on it. Yeah.
So used to thinking about amino acids as important because of evolution, because certain
Yeah.
I was wondering if you can imagine connecting this to bioinformatics of looking at variability at certain sites. And I don't have no idea how it would be done, but you're basically saying that two amino acid switches might be equivalent just based on whether and how much they change epsilon.
Yeah. Yeah, I like your question, and I think the answer is probably that yes, one could make some headway. Like, I probably can't, but for example, all the mutants that I showed you from Bonnie's lab, you know, you could probably look at the sequences of all those guys and try and maybe you could learn, oh, this is the region of the protein that's the epsilon region. For sure it's true for the case that I showed you of the repressor, you know, that Mitch Lewis knew very well what he was mutating, and I exploited that when I wrote down the model because he knew he was changing the DNA binding domain. He knew that. And so basically, you know, it was pretty clear what was going on with these different curves. So I think that progress could be made, but I think you'd probably need some data, and it's an interesting, you'd have to do some lots of functional studies and then also lots of species and different mutant studies, and maybe you'd be able to figure something out.
What I'm saying also is that in epsilon is the important quantity in a specific situation, for a specific question where you're claiming that the function is kind of dependent on this allosteric effect, right? Then you should be able to say in a database where you look at a sequence of many, many proteins, that here are the sites that are important, and these are the sites.
Yeah, I'm saying I agree with that, although it sounds super hard to actually figure it out in any way where you'd be able to know a priori whether you were making epsilon go up or down or any of that without just those stories. Question back there, and then you.
I'm sensing some of the misgivings from the biology side of the audience have to do with this fact, which that you somehow collapsed, let's say, the behavior of the 300 amino acid protein into 3 or 4 numbers. And actually, that's correct. And in a sense, if you'd given this whole talk and showed that hemoglobin or anything else collapsed into a 3-parameter family, that would also be quite amazing. I think the biology lies in the next bit where you showed it collapsed into a 1-parameter family. And so people should realize that if I gave you a protein that's not allosteric, I asked you to design some binding site so it would become allosteric, you would probably not be able to come back and give me a protein that had a 1-parameter fit. And that's what biology is. All the amino acids, all these questions have to do with that last beautiful design. And so the first part, three parameter collapse is physics, the 1-parameter collapse is biology. Is that correct?
That's fun. Yeah, I mean, and that's back to your question in a way. I personally have no idea how to move around in epsilon and K space in any smart way by saying, you know, I'll change this parameter. But I'll bet you there are people that do know how to do these things, and they probably know how to do it seat of the pants. Like, you know, I think I know that this domain is going. In fact, that's that paper on the ion channel, that's exactly what they did. It's position 9, and they changed, you know, they knew what they were doing. So these mutants, you can see, you know, they each leucine 9, I don't know why there's a prime, serine mutation shifts the dose response relation for acetylcholine to the left by tenfold. So, you know, there was an elbow in an alpha helix, and they knew what was going on, and they didn't interpret it as an epsilon mutant, but I do. Yeah.
So, one sort of smart and amusing and hopefully provoking question. Experimentally, what you had just suggested would either require in-depth knowledge of the protein structure, or conversely, if all you had was a database, you could potentially make some interesting predictions about protein structure, which might be very, very useful to structural biologists who spend years trying to get crystals or parameters. And so I think, is that?
No, I think it's true. I mean, I think that's the mission that Mitch Lewis is on with his lac repressor, because he wants to use it now in, he's got an amazing story where he's basically injecting lac repressor into the eyes, believe this or not, of blind kids, just one of the eyes. And they can see. In other words, he's interested in using it as a tunable, deliverable molecule that he can own. In other words, he's very interested in the leakiness and the dynamic range, and he's even interested in shifting it so that it's high at no ligand and goes to low, like the whole deal. So yeah, over here, and then maybe.
Basically, you try to infer from that, you know, you build a phylogeny, what the effects of mutations would be on, say, proteins to build. And I think basically it's like mutations you see are probably stabilizing or neutral, mutations you don't see are assumed to be destabilizing, and so you don't see them. And they did this for, say, influenza hemagglutinin and I think some other ones, and they were able to try to predict mutations on these structures that they think would stabilize and destabilize the proteins. And at least qualitatively, I guess, it more or less works in, like, of course, great sense of good or bad.
They know the structure very, very well and can correlate what the mutations are actually doing?
Well, in those cases, I think they go and actually test it. But I think in principle, the idea is you wouldn't have to know that. You could just do this computationally and say, oh, these are stabilizing, these will be destabilizing, and then hopefully they're mostly right.
Jorge, did you still want to ask something? And then Shelley, we'll go to you. Yeah.
But the ideal function can be concentrated. The activity at low concentration is basically not.
Good.
So, I mean, I know for some kids, you know, basically all that you're looking at is the preceptor or like speed kind of receptor. And very important in people don't. It could very well be that a lot of people that is not the case.
Wait, I'm still, I think I'm not following what your point is just yet. That's right.
What I'm saying is that in many cases, or probably in most cases of interest, for many people, this is basically just a fact, even if they're not a complete mechanistic.
Yeah. Well, that's why I told you that I'm like a religious zealot that you have to be careful of. Like, it does not satisfy my requirement of intellectual purity. I'm kidding around, but I really find it annoying that, for example, for an ion channel, there's nothing that makes sense about using Hill function that I can think of. But I do want to say, to echo your remark, this guy Steve Frank has written a couple of really interesting papers on the nature of input-output functions. And he has like 11 ways to get Hillness, or to get cooperativity. I really recommend people take a look at it, because he's claiming that it's very generic, and that it's something that, you know, biological systems do, which is kind of, somebody asked me, you know, is this your big question. He really thinks, you know, that getting the sort of sharpness, like Jim Farrell has also been doing things, but I think Steve Frank's is the more interesting, because it's very wide in its reach. So in that sense, you're right. What does the Hill function offer? It offers this sort of sigmoidal behavior. I just personally have no use for it. In other words, I just much prefer writing down a rational function. I don't mean rational like rational. I mean rational like the ratio of two polynomials, which is what this thing is, wherever it is. Yeah, this. So, you know, that's a rational function. But I should say, Jeremy Gunawardena has recently, with Angela DePace, shown, this comes back to whoever Shura's question, and again, very provocative and interesting. Notice that the ratio here, this is basically of two quadratics. And if you have the energy-consuming processes present, the order of the numerator is higher than quadratic. In other words, the numerator and the denominator do not have the same order, and that leads to some interesting new effects. I don't fully understand that yet, but again, that's what we're going to do in the theory rotation this next 2 weeks, to see what we can try to understand about that. Okay, Shelley. Mm-hmm.
you know, my guess is the fact that the leucine substitutions changed by, you know, factors of 10, I don't think they could have predicted that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, knowing the structure that is that if we change this leucine, they'll turn something up.
Yeah.
So I just want to make sure that people who don't think about the residues, who don't care so much about the residues, it's not as easy as it might sound to make a change and then have the protein do what we want it to do.
Okay. So I agree, but I'm going to respond by just saying again, in this very room, and also down the hall, I stormed out in anger one time in my former field, which was theoretical material science, because I get tired of the hype in that much easier field where people of my ilk would say, oh, we're going to, you know, the first paragraph of their PhysRev letters or the first paragraph of their grant is how we're going to design new fancy ass materials on the computer, and it's and that's an abject failure also. So yeah, I'm not saying that it's easy. I make no claims that it's easy. I'm just saying I would like to understand the phenomenology that's seen. You know, coming back to Shura's point, often these experiments are in vitro, so it's not the real cell. I'm going to go for the little steps for little feet philosophy. So that's what I'm trying to do. Just understand a little bit. No claims about knowing how to design it. Yeah, no, but I'm just saying, I agree with you, and it's even worse than you say. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe last question. Andrew.
Right, but I guess it doesn't point to the case you mentioned, the counter example, which is where intelligent analysis of a protein identified different parts of it, which were supposed to do different things, and the mutants did precisely different things that they were supposed to do. So it sort of depends on how intelligently you would approach the problem.
Cool. So let me tell everyone, at least the program people, what's going to happen in here at 11. So the course for the next 2 weeks is now going to break up into research rotations where each of the students has already been assigned to one of four groups, and they're going to, over the next 2 weeks, try to actually discover things. And then on Saturday, 2 weeks from now, we're going to have presentations, say, from 9 until noon, and we hope that you guys will come because it promises to be very interesting. But just as far as what's going to happen at 11, the four PIs are each going to give a 15-minute talk that's aimed at the other students that are not in their rotation to tell them what they're up to. And the reason I'm telling you this is that we're going to try to stick to our schedule. So I'm hoping that people will be game for the idea of not interrupting, because the point is simply just to explain what we're up to. Unless there's some clarification, then maybe at lunch if you're worried about it. So I'm not trying to damp down discussion or anything. It's just that we're kind of on a tight schedule. That's my thought. So at any rate, we have a half hour break. And
but we're welcome to come and listen.
Absolutely. You're invited to come and listen, yeah.